million buckaroos. Last year the Warren Buffett held the jet.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush, Tuesday nights on KBOO. 2 hours of global bass with an emphasis on South Asia and the South Asian diaspora, and an even more special emphasis on the Punjabi diaspora. Hosted every Tuesday, 10 to midnight, by The Incredible Kid. This ain't world music, it's birth of a new world music.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, our weekly segment, Genocide Watch, with Sam Husseini. Today, Sam connects the dots between child rapist Jeffrey Epstein, the Mossad, and everything Israeli. Let's say it that way. Also, the U.S. under Trump continues its arms buildup and expanding threats of a possible invasion in Venezuela. We'll speak to Steve Elner, an associate editor of Latin American Perspectives, and we'll also hear about a local forum and speak out plan for Berkeley on resisting endless Trump wars. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Hey, And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And we're going to begin off the show today with our weekly edition of Genocide Watch. We usually do it on Monday, but we were preempted. So we are happy to invite Sam Husseini back for our regular edition of Genocide Watch. Sam, welcome back to Flashpoints. I want to talk in a little bit about Epstein and the whole Zionist Israeli movement. There's a lot there. And that relationship that Epstein had with the Israelis sort of demonstrates the corruptness in terms of U.S. participation in the genocide and their willingness to work with anybody, including a child rapist. But Sam, I want to start in the West Bank, because it really does seem like the Israelis are moving fast, expanding, the violence is getting deeper, and I thought we would start there.
Sure, Dennis. I mean, it's gotten to the point in the West Bank that I think even the mainstream is having to note it to some degree. It's that they're just wanton attacks, on a dramatically escalating basis by Israeli settlers, as you know, Palestinians are trying to, you know, pick their olives for olive season. So you've even had the Israeli president say it's shocking, the settler violence. But I think that this is sort of an attempt to, you know, put at arm's length something that's become so brazen, but it is a very serious thing, and dramatically in attempting to intimidate and perhaps spiral to perhaps trigger an all-out conflict, an all-out assault on the West Bank. So it's kind of interesting to see even the mainstream sort of noting that at this point, but it is literally a record level of violence on the West Bank, you know, as compared to over the last several decades.
I noticed there was a really vicious attack on the Hajja Hamida Mosque. A blaze was seen for miles, and it was a blatant attack. I think that's one of those attacks that's getting international attention. That's the voice of Sam Husseini. This is Flashpoints. Sam, let's talk. First of all, also let's say something about Gaza, because clearly Israelis, you know, they call it a ceasefire, but the fires never ceased, and it's been a real struggle to get a few extra, not extra, but a few trucks through based on what is really being held back and what's needed. It's a difficult moment.
Absolutely.
Might as well mention that.
Absolutely, Dennis. I was just in contact with, I know he's been on your show, Dr. Farwaz Shadwa,
yes.
And he's not able to get into Gaza. He's gotten in before, even during, you know, the full-fledged genocide, and now during a so-called ceasefire, he's not able to get in. Aid organizations have been particularly highlighting not only is there a not only are there severe restrictions still in terms of getting medical and food aid in, but there's almost a blanket prohibition about getting shelter in tents, building supplies, and so on with the winter coming. This could be cataclysmic. You even had a report from the BBC, interestingly enough, which has been, you know, incredibly pro-Israel. You know, people might recall they were gutted in the aftermath of the Iraq War. Israel has destroyed more than 1,500 buildings in Gaza since the quote-unquote ceasefire. So Israel continues to control directly more than half of Gaza. They're in effect partitioning it, you know, sort of like what they've done with the West Bank, and of course making you know, conditions unbearable for Palestinians, with the obvious long-term goal of continuing to ethnically cleanse. That's still clearly the goal.
That's the goal. Well, we're going to keep an eye on that. And whatever they're calling a ceasefire, it's obviously an incredibly treacherous time to be in Gaza. And now, of course, as we said, in the West Bank as well. Sam, Jeffrey Epstein is at the center of the controversy that could easily bring down the President of the United States. And you've got the holier-than-thou Democrats dying to prosecute the case. And who wouldn't want to see Trump tried for his relationship with Epstein and whatever he may have been engaged with? But you can't, the Democrats... and the Democratic leadership can't really separate itself from the kinds of actions and policies that Epstein participated in to support the Zionists and expand the genocide in Palestine. So it really is a hard one for them to explain how they're sort of different when it comes to this relationship. You want to talk about Epstein in the context of what's going on in Israeli support for Israel?
I'll do the best I can, Dennis. There are several layers to this. You're right. Epstein had a very close relationship with Trump and with Clinton. I mean, he visited the Clinton White House like 17 times. So he's had extensive relationship with both sides. One thing that's interesting is how the political parties sort of switched positions on the whole Epstein disclosure question over the last year. People might recall during the last so-called election cycle, it was Republicans, including Kash Patel, who's now FBI director, and... others closely associated with Trump, including members of his family, who were going on about how the deep state was keeping the Epstein files under wraps and so on. And then when Trump gets in, he's saying there's nothing to see here, including Kash Patel. So the position, and suddenly the Democrats are interested in something, the establishment Democrats are interested in something that they expressed very little interest in before. And they're trying to tie it as much as they can with Trump. I suspect they're trying to tie it to Trump without, you know, as you sort of indicated in your question, Dennis, you know, exposing the whole apple cart of how Epstein was tied not just to both parties, but to the broader elite establishment. I mean, he's closely associated with billionaires like Les Wexner, like Peter Thiel, and several others. It's amazing to hear Democrats over the last couple of months talk about Jeffrey Epstein, you know, how Trump is protecting Jeffrey Epstein and his billionaire buddies, but they never name those billionaire buddies. It's certainly not Les Wexner, who really put Epstein into action, buying him his palatial largest residential home in Manhattan, for example, founder of Victoria's Secret's catalog. Now, another thing that the mainstream coverage and both political parties have stayed away from is the connection to Israel. And what was interesting is that Drop Site News has gone through, that they got a trove of hacked emails, which includes stuff, material from Ehud Barak, who's a former Israeli prime minister, as well as for a time he was head of Mossad, and for a time he was their so-called defense minister. His emails with Epstein for several years. And this, you know, this is sort of the nail in the coffin of anybody who was still pretending that Epstein wasn't a, you know, I hesitate to say the word asset for the for Israeli Mossad, because at points, if you read some of the interactions between Barak and Epstein, it's more Epstein giving direction to Barak rather than the other way around.
The former Israeli prime minister you're talking about, Ehud Barak, yes.
That's correct. After he left public office, he was obviously very interested in making money, and he and Epstein talked about how to do business deals in, throughout Asia and elsewhere, getting meetings with Kremlin, with Putin and other Kremlin officials to try to do deals in Russia. He helped, Epstein helped them do a security arrangement with Mongolia, helped Barak and other Israeli officials sell surveillance equipment to Cote d'Ivoire in Africa. So it was, you know, several layers to this. And perhaps most significantly of the pieces that they've written, this is Drop Site News off of these hacked emails. They tried to nudge Russia to get Assad out of Syria and tried to find ways of getting the U.S. to attack Iran. I think what Drop Site News has done in these reports is valuable, but they almost sort of missed the forest for the trees at times, you know, saying that this effort failed. And it did fail when it happened between the two of them 10 years ago. But the fact of the matter is that both those things eventually happened. Assad was forced out, apparently with at least Russian acquiescence. Bashar Assad ended up taking refuge in Russia. And the U.S. did eventually attack Iran. Trump did that earlier this year. I should note, I think I was on your show September 31st on the Epstein stuff. People might want to look at that, because part of what happened over the summer was that the other aspect of this is, you know, is there blackmail? Is Trump and other U.S. officials and presidents and so on being blackmailed by Epstein / Israel? Earlier this year, right around the time that Trump seemed to be making noises that he was going to, you know, tell Netanyahu that he had to calm down at his level of violence, that he had to pipe it down, you simultaneously had Elon Musk post on his platform X that Trump was in the Epstein files, and you simultaneously had the Democratic leader Chuck Schumer put out a video where he chastised Trump for not attacking Iran. This was the whole taco thing. Trump always chickens out. It seemed to be a concerted effort to effectively push Trump to back off from forcing Netanyahu into backing off from Iran and into a ceasefire in Gaza during the summer. And he did. Trump actually backed up Israel's attack on Iran, and totally backed off, at least for a time, on the entire ceasefire thing until relatively recently, about a month ago, when you had this so-called ceasefire, which I believe the U.S. and Israel were pushed to because of the pressure applied in other quarters, most obviously Colombia moving to get the General Assembly to vote for Uniting for Peace resolution. I think that's what compelled the so-called Trump plan and the so-called Trump ceasefire. So, you know, there are, you know, several dimensions to the Epstein story. The establishment wants to paint it I agree with you, Dennis. It'd be fine to see Trump go down, but we have to be careful that even an insidious figure like Trump, is he going down because he did something wrong, or is he going down because he might actually polarize with some part of the establishment? I that wouldn't be my first guess, but I don't think that we can dismiss that. I mean, when everybody was saying that Trump is laying down a law for Netanyahu over the summer, I was very skeptical of this. But if you look at the timeline, it is interesting how Musk and Schumer chimed in when they did. Now, right now, Ghislaine Maxwell, who was Jeffrey Epstein's co-conspirator, is living a quite cushy life at what's called Club Fed, and seems to be in line for a pardon from Trump. So it seems to be very much a case of one hand scratches the other, one hand touches the other. Maxwell may well have dirt on Trump, and that in return for her silence, he's ensuring that she gets cushy treatment, and eventually gets a full-fledged partner for her pardon for her crimes. So that's, I think, some of the dynamics that are going on here.
And well, we're speaking with Sam Husseini. Every week we do what we call Genocide Watch, and it's focusing on Gaza and the West Bank as we see that while there is some form of a ceasefire, the Israeli vision of surrounding, undermining, and continuing to control through heavy weaponry supplied by the United States is continuing apace. It is interesting that the structural support, secret support, and overt support for Israel has been going on for years. I'm noting that at one point, I wonder why I think it's been reported that a Israeli spy or spies stayed for weeks or months at Epstein's apartment in Manhattan. What could that spy have been doing while they're hanging out with Epstein and whoever else is coming through that situation?
Well, it's really not clear from the Drop Site News report. It is a fascinating report on this spy who stayed at a facility by Epstein's, not the main one apparently, and who was taken. He's sort of a protege of Barack. So what we have are the emails between Ehud Barak, former Israeli Prime Minister, and Epstein describing Epstein's interactions with this Mossad asset. And they're very cryptic. It's exactly the way that mobsters talk. It's like, be sure to tell him to return the earplugs that I the earpiece that I bought at the Mac store on 86th Street. It seems to be a code that they're talking about getting this Israeli spy to do various things. We don't know what they're actually talking about. We don't know what this code means, but it's quite clearly a code that they're giving direction to do something for some obviously nefarious purpose, because they're speaking in this code. And one footnote on this whole thing part of the reason that they seem to be speaking in this code is that according to the documents leaked by Edward Snowden, you know, after this interaction happened, this whole interaction happened a little over 10 years ago, that there seemed to be a concerted effort from parts of the NSA to be spying on Israeli assets. So it seems that they were, you know, very sensitive to the fact that the NSA might be spying on them, and that accounts for part of it. So we really don't know what's going on here, but we do know that quite clearly that Epstein is either an Israeli asset or somebody who's actually giving direction to Israel at a very, very high level.
You don't let spies in your living room. You don't have spies. Everybody doesn't have spies in their living room for months at a time without a structural governmental connection. And clearly, the Israelis would be wise enough to know, given the situation that where the spies were staying, that they would be, the Americans would be very vulnerable just in case there was some breakdown between the Israelis and the Americans. This gives the Israelis a lot of power to control U.S. policy for their own good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think at certain levels, the U.S. and Israeli establishments are very much, or completely hand in hand. But there are, quote unquote, Boy Scouts within some parts of the U.S. government that might actually say, hey, Israel's breaking the law here. I'm going to do something about it. So I think that there's some sensitivity to that in terms of how parts of the, parts of the interaction between the two governments.
Maybe just to put a bit of a fine point on it, the fact that it's Trump and Clinton are the ones with the most access or have the most experience with the child rapist, it would seem to me that would also be make it very clear that it's sort of a bipartisan policy at a lot of different levels. And it was at the time Clinton was trying to distract his own problems around Monica Lewinsky. So I believe one of the things that Clinton was busy doing, he may have been disrespecting women. We don't know his relationship with Epstein, but we know that Clinton murdered Leila al-Attar this was a famous Iraqi artist, because Clinton was trying to distract from his problems on the domestic front and killed this incredibly famous artist from Iraq who was celebrated around the world. I just bring this up because all of it is sort of it's deadly, it's disgusting, and it shows an extraordinary amount of racism and sexism in the context of U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, there are many aspects to this, but, you bring up the Lewinsky thing. Part of, the subtext here is, one question was, what's the connection to Israel here? And the other question was, how much are we talking about blackmail being a factor here? And there's some evidence that in the Lewinsky thing, the Times of Israel reported back in 2014 that Israel attempted to use tapes of former U.S. president steamy conversations with intern Monica Lewinsky to leverage the release of Jonathan Pollard. Others, wondered, if that had that was also leveraged because Israel was apparently spying on Clinton and knew about the Lewinsky scandal before everybody else did, and were they attempting to leverage it for
yes.
that? And you did
right.
you did have Clinton continuously. He bombed the Sudan and he bombed Iraq. Time for his impeachment, trials and tribulations. So, you know, was that an attempt at a distraction, or was he sort of almost paying off part of the establishment to do the bidding of the establishment to such an extent that they would acquiesce to his continuing to stay in power? I think one can hypothesize both ways. We're interestingly enough now seeing Trump harangue the Israeli president Herzog about pardoning Netanyahu, so that he can, you know, hit all of his crimes seem, you know, in that what they're talking about pardoning. They're not talking about pardoning him for genocide and so on. They're talking about pardoning him for his financial crimes. But he's proven himself so useful to the U.S.-Israeli empire, having successfully committed so much carnage, that it's almost like Trump and Adelson and so on, you know, want to really help out the Bibi Netanyahu because he's done so much to advance Israel's imperial project. So I think it's important to, you know, people might say, what does this have to do with, you know, Genocide Watch, Epstein, and all of this stuff? I mean, the question is, why is Israel able to do all of this? And what are the mechanisms of control? Some of them are obvious, like AIPAC and all the money that AIPAC gives to U.S. political figures. And there's geopolitical stuff as well, and so on. But this Epstein thing, the connections there, the potential for blackmail, and the fact that it sort of melds with the geopolitical stuff, that you have Jeffrey Epstein, you know, he's not like just a pimp, you know, he's not just a blackmailer, and he's not just a spy. He's telling Ehud Barak, former Israeli prime minister, how to sell the idea of attacking Iran to the U.S. public. And Barak is incredibly deferential to him, so it's sort of a window into this elite set of, you know, billionaires and apparatchiks, and how they intermesh with a very unique nation like Israel.
Yeah, well, there's a lot more to say about this. We've been speaking with Sam Hussein. He joins us every week, usually on Mondays, when we do what we call Genocide Watch. And we are watching Israel very closely. We should say, just in leaving, Sam, we need to say that the winter is coming in Gaza, just to emphasize this. And the desperation and the suffering is only going to grow given the resistance of the Israelis to let the stuff go through. So this is something we really want to keep an eye on, right?
Absolutely, Dennis.
All right. Thanks, Sam. Thanks for joining us.
That's the reality.
That's the reality sandwich. Based on this kind of policy we've been talking about. Okay. All right, we're going to leave it right there. Be safe, Sam. We'll talk to you next week. And you all are going to stay with me. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to turn our attention back to what's happening with the U.S. attacks on Venezuela and the region. And there's a lot to talk about there. Stay with us. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're happy to welcome to these airwaves Steve Ellner. He's an associate managing editor of the Latin American Perspectives Group and a retired professor at the Universidad de Orient in Venezuela, where he lived for over 40 years. He's the author of Rethinking Venezuelan Politics, Class Conflict, and the Chavez Phenomenon. He has a current piece, a piece in current Jacobin. And Professor, we welcome you to Flashpoints. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Now, the actions of the Trump administration in terms of making war, attacking boats, threatening, building up major forces in the region, it's both negative, but it certainly has had the impact of united the countries in the region. I think everybody remembers the Monroe Doctrine and U.S. visions of control in the region of resources. And so it's bringing people together. But let's start. Do you think the United States would dare a land war against Venezuela? They're saying everybody's united and they got millions ready to fight the invaders.
Well, you know, the New York Times published an article a couple of days ago based on interviews with people on the inside of the Trump administration. And they reported that the Trump administration is considering three possible strategies. And one is boots on the ground. But the other is taking over the oil fields in order to starve the government. You know, Venezuela depended completely on oil production. And so that's another strategy. And the other is to try to kidnap, seize Maduro, something similar to what they did in Panama in 1989. It's hard to say. You know, we really can't discard anything. You know, President Trump is unpredictable. But what is certain is with this heavy presence in the Caribbean, there were 10,000 soldiers, 5,000 in Puerto Rico and 5,000 on board of on ships. And now the USS Ford aircraft carrier, which is the most modern carrier in the U.S. arsenal, and it's the most advanced and the most destructive. It has just arrived. It's in Puerto Rico now. It was in the Middle East. And so so this brings 5,000 more soldiers. So there are 15,000 soldiers now in the Caribbean. And it's not to believe that Trump isn't going to do anything. I mean, I don't think after this he's just going to pull back. And he has stated in an interview just a day or two ago that, you know, he wants to see Maduro, President Nicolas Maduro, out of there. And he's set on forcing him out of power. So it's really hard to know what's in store for Venezuela at this point.
Well, what do you hear from the ground? What's the word on the ground? What are people saying about what they will do? Are there plans? Are there significant plans to resist? What can you tell? You spent most of your life in the country.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you that people are telling me that people are rallying behind the government. Not to say that everybody, you know, supports the government or voted for the government in the last elections, but given the situation, given the fact that Venezuela is being threatened this way, and not only that, an accumulation of different issues, immigration, you know, the way Trump singled out Venezuelan immigrants, this won over a lot of people to the need to, you know, participate in some kind of united front. And this is what President Maduro is calling for, a united front. And people are telling me that all kinds of people are enrolling in the militia. People who don't support Maduro, but they're enrolling. In fact, the head of one of the main opposition parties, in fact, the traditionally largest party in Venezuela, Democratic Action, Acción Democrática in Spanish, Bernabé Gutierrez, he had one of two factions of the Acción Democrática Party, and he's calling on people to enroll in the militia. Now, he's opposition, but other opposition people as well. Two presidential candidates against Chavez and against Maduro, Manuel Rosales, who ran against Chavez in 2006, and Enrique Capriles, who ran against Chavez in 2012 and then against Maduro in 2013. I mean, these are opposition figures. And they are supporting the idea of a dialogue with the government. And they're broken completely with the hardcore, you know, radical opposition on the right, which is headed by Maria Corina Machado. They have broken with her. Antonio Ecarri, who's another centrist, who's a presidential candidate. You see people who are moderate leftists, people like Elias Hauer, who was a key person in the Chavez administration, Chavez's inner circle. He's somewhat to the left of Maduro, and he's very critical. They've all rallied around the idea of the need for a united front. So this, I think, reflects sentiment on the ground. And I think that any kind of action against Venezuela would be met with a united response.
You write in your recent article, you write, when Donald Trump assumed the presidency in January 2025, the pink tide governments in Latin America were losing ground. The approval rating of Brazil's president reached its lowest, an all-time low. And you go on to talk about real problems in the region. And then you talk about Trump's aggression uniting forces. What do you mean by that? How have countries come together in the face of these threats and this expanding force U.S. is building in the region?
Well, for instance, in the case of Brazil, Lula, who's the president of Brazil, who's a leftist or central leftist, who maintains an independent position vis-a-vis the United States and Russia and China. He's a nationalist. And very popular, but nevertheless, his support, his approval rating was only 30%. And that's changed. What Trump has done is a game changer for Latin American politics. His rating is now 50%, and he just announced that he was going to run for president again in the elections that will take place in October of next year. And so that's one example of somebody who's on the left, whose popularity was, way below 50%, and now the situation has changed. In Chile, there were elections, there were primaries, primary elections to nominate the main candidate to run against the right, because Chile is, divided between the left and the right. But a member of the Communist Party by the name of Jara, she won those primaries with a 60% vote. Now, this was a vote of moderates, not only leftists, but moderates, centrists. The central left, which is a socialist party, they all participated in the election, and her 60.5% of the vote was surprising. But I think it's a sign of the times. I think people, I think that Trump has polarized Latin America, very much so, between the right and the left. And the right is really at a disadvantage because of Trump's positions on immigration, now his threats of intervention, military intervention in Venezuela, but also, as you mentioned, the bombing of these boats in the Caribbean. Few people in Latin America understand that. He says that it was because these people were running drugs But the fact of the matter is, he didn't issue the names of the people. He supposedly knew all about them, but there was no information about these people who were killed. And so I think that Latin America is being polarized, and that has a lot to do with Trump's policies and Trump's actions.
What do you think in terms of influences from China? It seems like given the problems that the United States is creating in the region and Trump's desire for apparent some kind of confrontation, is this a time when allegiances will change? Will Venezuela, will countries of the region become more interested, more engaged by China? China is certainly out there saying, hey, we'll help.
Hello?
Hello, can you hear me? So the question is, what are the implications for power shifts?
Yeah, I understand the question. I don't see Latin America becoming, you know, pro-Chinese. I don't think, you know, the situation today...
It sounds fun.
It's different from the Cold War. During the Cold War... You know, the Soviet Union was exporting a model. It was, you know, socialism, Soviet style. Communist parties were loyal to Moscow in all the countries throughout the world. The situation today is different. The Chinese are not overtly, at least, exporting a model. They talk about socialism with Chinese characters. So you don't have, you don't have communist parties. You don't have parties throughout the world, and certainly not in Latin America, that are closely aligned with China. But China has definitely gained some points as a result of the situation today with Trump. And just to give one example, when Trump slapped a 50% tariff on Brazil, partly because Brazil was, it was a judicial proceeding against the ex-president Bolsonaro, who's a Trump ally. He was involved in a plot to, or at least accused of a plot to assassinate Lula, a plot to overthrow Lula, overthrow the government after Lula won the elections. So there's a trial, and he was placed under house arrest. And Trump moved in and slapped Brazil with a 50% tariff and stated that part of the reason for this tariff is because Bolsonaro was unjustly being tried. This produced, you know, protests throughout Brazil. And one of the things is that Brazil depends on the export of soybeans to the United States. So that was slapped with a 50% tariff. And so Brazil turned to China and started exporting soya to China. They're both members of BRICS, which is an organization that groups, you know, Russia, China, Brazil, India, South Africa. And so Brazil turned to China. And so the Chinese have benefited because they present themselves as rational players, especially in the field of commerce and the field of investment. The United States, under Trump, has weaponized tariffs. And this has produced a lot of resentment throughout the hemisphere. And I think that the Chinese are viewed as more rational and playing by the rules of the game in terms of international financial, economic, and commercial transactions.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, speaking with Professor Steve Ellner, and we're talking about the desire of the President of the United States to, I guess, threaten and control, reinstitute the Monroe Doctrine. It seems like the President of the United States wants to move things backwards everywhere as soon as possible. What are your, as we get ready to say goodbye, what are your concerns now? What are you watching closely in terms of U.S. moves, and what would it mean if the United States was brazen enough to go on land in Venezuela. It would seem to me that is going to open up a lot of negative possibilities, and it could be trouble in the region for a long time to come.
Yeah, I think that, you know, what I've read among some strategists is that, you know, we did it in Panama, we did it in Grenada, and we can do it in Venezuela. There's little consideration among those strategists of the difference between Venezuela and Panama and Grenada. Firstly, in terms of size, in terms of population, but also in terms of, at least comparing Venezuela with Panama, the mobilization capacity of the government. The government has a mobilization capacity. The possibility that, you know, you'd have a regional conflict here. Maduro has called on people throughout Latin America to resist any kind of invasion of his country. And you might see, you know, the guerrilla movement of Colombia, which, you know, after the peace accord, most of the guerrillas laid down their arms. But you could very well see the activation of that force. And that would be a very, very ugly situation. It would be another drawn-out conflict. I think that in terms of U.S. politics, Trump would lose at least a segment of his base, which, you know, supported Trump precisely because he opposed permanent war. That was his campaign, you know, promise in 2024. And so I see it as a very messy kind of situation if Trump decides to intervene militarily in Venezuela.
Wow. Professor Steve Ellner, we want to thank you for taking the time out and sharing your incredible experience and your information and knowledge about the region. I hope you come back and keep us posted. We appreciate the information.
By all means, and thank you again for the invitation.
You're absolutely welcome. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Another short break, and then we're going to be joined by Jeff Mackler. There's going to be a teach-in, educational conference teach-in happening in Berkeley, and Jeff's going to tell you all about it. Stay with us. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Old friend of this show, Jeff Mackler, longtime Bay Area activist. For those of you who listen in the Bay Area and live in the Bay Area, you know Jeff Mackler. If you've been active in the streets, you've seen him in the streets. And if you were at a protest or a teach-in, he probably had something to do with it. Jeff, you're busy again. You got some interesting things coming up. There's a teach-in educational conference that you're main organizer of, casts of thousands. First of all, give us your gut reaction. You think Trump is going to go into Venezuela, and what would that mean? Give us your hit on that.
Well, Trump is capable of anything. And as we speak, the Gerald Ford aircraft carrier is, roughly speaking, off the coast of Venezuela. It is perhaps the most powerful armada in the world, armed with every conceivable type of weapon and backed by accompanying battleships, with a threat by the President of the United States to invade. Of course, the real reason for the invasion has nothing to do with the fact that the Venezuelans are alleged to be drug smugglers. In truth, the largest amount of money in the world that goes through the drug industry from Mexico and elsewhere goes through U.S. banks, which yes. We've documented. On the major point, the Venezuelans have arms from Russia, China, and Iran that are capable of sinking that ship. If there was an attack on Venezuela, it would be a prelude. It could be a prelude to world war. So we're all hoping that the insanity of U.S. politics, and I say insanity, the United States is no minor player. It has 1,100 military bases in 110 countries around the world. Your previous speaker mentioned Grenada. I was in Grenada right before the U.S. invaded and slaughtered the people of that tiny country, literally 24 miles by 10. But Venezuela, the real question, has nothing to do with drugs and everything to do with the fact that it's the number one oil producing and oil reserve country in the world. And interestingly enough, so is Iran, which the United States attacked with impunity for 30 days and modern weapons. So was Libya. So is Syria. So is the Middle East. In each and every one of these countries, the United States' central objective was oil, money, resources, gold, bauxite, tin, manganese, and so on. So the United States imperial government is on the move. This coming Saturday, November 15th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., we have our Bay Area response. And that response is matched in 50 other cities across the country, and our demands are trillions for human needs, not U.S. wars. Free Palestine, hands off Venezuela, and no to ICE raids. We have some two dozen speakers representing every point of view, leading Haitian activists, civil liberties, leaders from the National Lawyers Guild, Rick Sterling from the Task Force in the Americas, Paul Cox, from Veterans for Peace, myself, two former death row political prisoners, innocent people, Kevin Cooper and Mumia Abu-Jamal. We have Nora Bowers-Friedman from the Palestinian group. We have Menadel Herjala from the Palestinian U.S. Palestinian Community Network, Judy Greenspan from the Teachers Union, and environmentalists like Jack Fleck, and many other speakers, including our national coordinator, Joe Lombardo from United National Anti-War Coalition. So this is a major Bay Area nationally coordinated teach-in in Berkeley at the Berkeley Fellowship of Unitarian Universalist Church. Admission is basically minimal. Everyone is welcome. There'll be lots of discussion, debate, panels, workshops, questions, and opinions expressed, but all based on trillions for human needs, not U.S. wars.
Jeff, what do you think the crucial issues are now? We're at a crossroads. Clearly, your outline of a potential war down south is troubling and not far-fetched. What are the things you really think we need to do something about? What are the specifics?
Well, our very specific demands is the U.S. out now. It's the out now demand that we had in Vietnam when we mobilized millions of people and forced the United States, which had its pretext for invading Vietnam and killing 6 million people. We want the United States government out. We want to qualitatively change the military budget, trillions for human needs, not endless wars everywhere on Earth. We want to stop all U.S. interventions. We want to support the right of poor and oppressed nations to self-determination. We don't want American citizens or non-citizens or human beings, no human being is illegal, to be deported because they're threatened with taking our jobs when the Trump administration and the Democrats before them offshored millions of jobs to low-wage countries to raise the unemployment rate, the real unemployment rate in the United States, to unprecedented levels. So we want jobs for working people. We want to build a massive Democratic United Front coalition of everyone who agrees with these fundamental demands. Trillions for human needs, not war. Out now, self-determination for the oppressed and beleaguered people of the world. And of course, democratic rights for the American people. Stop the cutbacks, stop the attacks on medical care. So it's a movement demand aimed at uniting everyone to spend trillions on human needs, on the needs of the American people, if not the world's people, rather than endless wars everywhere on the planet Earth.
Beautiful. Give us the details again, because we're just about out of time. How can people participate if they'd like?
Everyone can participate. It's Saturday, this coming Saturday, November 15th, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Berkeley Fellowship of Unitarian Universalist Church. The address is 1924 Cedar Street at Bonita in Berkeley. Admission is minimal. No one turned away for lack of funds. Come and join the discussion and debate. Meet activists from every social movement in the country. Hear experts speak on Venezuela, Palestine, Haiti, civil liberties, political prisoners, immigrant rights, ICE raids, and all the rest. Join the fight for a massive democracy and mobilization this coming week.
Thank you, Jeff Mackler. As always, we appreciate your extraordinarily good work for the people. Please stay safe, and hopefully I'll see you over the weekend. Talk to you soon.
Terrific. You're invited to be among our wonderful speakers, and thanks to you and Flashpoint.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeff. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And you know what? We're out of here.
And that does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments,